Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Drop and Go Parking. Offering easy and convenient parking, allowing you to hand over your keys and go directly to departures.
Welcome to Playback. It has been a tumultuous and distressing week for international news. On Wednesday, Poland shot down drones in its airspace during a large Russian airstrike on Ukraine. And it did this with the backing of military aircraft from its NATO allies, the first time a member of the Western military alliance is known to have fired shots during Russia's war in Ukraine. On Morning Ireland, Liam Nolan, Eastern European reporter in Warsaw, gave this account.
What we know at this point is that at least 10 Russian drones that were targeting Western Ukraine entered Polish airspace in the early hours this morning. Some of those drones were shot down by Poland's air defences. Some were not, and Poland's armed services are trying to locate those drones. I notice in the last few minutes that one of the independent Polish broadcasters, Polsat News, is reporting that one of the drones struck a residential building in the village of Wawrzyki in eastern Poland, but nobody was injured, according to those reports. And the broadcaster is citing local police as its source for that. Poland's armed forces are calling this an act of aggression and that the attacks posed a real threat to the safety of Polish citizens.
Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk told Parliament that it was the closest they'd been to open conflict since World War II, although he did say he had no reason to believe we're on the brink of war. For more reaction, Claire spoke to Polish journalist Wojciech Koszk.
We are seeing some pictures coming through now of the drones that have been found. These are huge, these drones, aren't they? 11 foot long, 8 foot wide, capable of carrying up to 50 kilograms of explosives. So what is Donald Tusk saying needs to happen now in terms of a reaction and a response from the EU and from NATO?
The Prime Minister said in the Parliament just this morning that Poland is going to invoke Article 4 of NATO, which is triggering consultations between allies when any of them feels threatened. Poland has long said it's the crucial frontline country for NATO and is a major hub of military and other help to Ukraine. And Tusk will most certainly just emphasize it more that the EU must invest more in security over the eastern flank.
Now, Moscow has denied targeting the country and said that there is no evidence the drones were even Russian. Also with Claire, John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus.
I mean, it's not clear why Moscow wants to pick a fight right now. It's possible, as Prime Minister Tusk of Poland has said, that this is a large-scale provocation. It's possible that these were misprogrammed. But I think one of the things that this sad war has taught us is the extent of Russian military incompetence. And I think it is possible that what's happened is that some regional commander has simply not realised that these line of flight for his drone went across Polish territory.
Yeah, I mean, the other school of thought, John, is that he is testing NATO, particularly in light of his dealings with Donald Trump and Donald Trump's decision to pull back from Ukraine to a certain extent and to tell Europe and the EU that this is your problem. And Vladimir Putin is capitalising on that.
Yes, that is another possible explanation. It may be that this was carefully planned and carefully executed. We'll probably never know for sure which of those two versions is correct.
However, on the News at One, Gavin put a similar question to Vitaly Chevchenko, Russia editor with BBC Monitoring.
Given the scale, the increasing scale of drones being sent into Ukraine by Russia at the moment, is there any possibility that this was an accident?
Well, we're talking about at least 19 drones. That's according to the Polish Prime Minister, two dozen according to the Ukrainian President Zelensky. So how do you lose two dozen drones? How can this be an accident? It's unlikely. That's, you know, what my knowledge about drone warfare tells me.
But what now for Poland, Europe and NATO?
Why would Russia do this now, and what would it expect as a response?
Well, they're not expecting much as a response. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it, Gavin. Over the past, well, 3.5 years of waging their full-scale war in Ukraine, Russia has been consistently ramping up their attacks. And without a meaningful response from the West, what they've seen is basically an open door, an invitation to step up and expand these attacks, because the West has failed to stop or even contain these attacks in Ukraine. And this is what the Ukrainians have been warning about for years. It's not going to stop in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin's policy is that of expansionism and opportunism. So if he's been testing Ukraine's defences and Western defences, and if he's not been met with a meaningful and powerful response, of course he's going to push for more. Of course he's going to see if attacking Poland will work to, you know, increase splits and divisions between NATO allies. Yes. And that's, I think, is what he's expecting.
From Wednesday's News at One. And on Tuesday, an Israeli attack on senior Hamas leaders in the Qatari capital, Doha. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned this as a flagrant violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Qatar. On Drive Time, Cormac put this to Greg Carlstrom, Middle East correspondent with The Economist.
What has the reaction been to this attack by Israel?
Uniformly negative across the region, Cormac. I think it's impossible to overstate how shocking this was for countries in the region, how much of a taboo or a red line it seems that Israel has crossed here. We've heard the Saudi crown prince in a phone call with the Emir of Qatar describe this as a criminal act. A diplomatic advisor to the president of the United Arab Emirates called it treacherous. Some of these leaders do not necessarily like the Qataris or trust the Qataris. There's a lot of bad blood between some of the countries in the Gulf. But the fact that Israel carried out, you know, a daylight airstrike on a residential neighborhood in Doha, in the Qatari capital, is something that's going to unnerve everybody across this region.
Also on Wednesday, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen proposed suspending the EU-Israel trade deal, citing the humanitarian situation in Gaza. On the News at One, Gavin spoke to Middle East analyst Borzu Daragahi about the attack in Doha and also got reaction to that EU proposal.
Despite the tougher talk and the reaction that she got, there's no sign, or is there any sign, that European countries are going to move with any strength or any on Israel after 2.5 years of doing arguably very little?
Well, some have, including Ireland, Spain as well. There's, you know, a groundswell of this. Is Israel has become so unpopular worldwide that countries are being sort of forced to act. Politicians are being forced to respond to the demands of their constituents in terms of watching this. But this was just a step too far, even for Ursula von der Leyen. You know, as I said, this is the place, this is the conduit, this is the office where if you want to send a proposal to Hamas, if you want to get Hamas to do this or that, this is where you send it to. And it's hosted by Qatar almost as a favor to the U.S. and to the EU and so on. Qatar actually has no real ideological commitment. It's a country, a wealthy gas and oil monarchy, one of the highest living rates in the world. It has no ideological commitment to this grassroots militant group. And it hosts it as it did, you know, hosts the Taliban's political representatives during the crises in Afghanistan, almost as a favor to the West.
Yes, but it does so with the protection of the U.S., who've been, well, quite mute on what's happened here.
Well, even Trump said that this was not something that he had expected and that he wanted to happen. I'm not sure if we should trust Trump. He has been somewhat unable sometimes to adhere to the truth when he makes statements about this topic. And there is a sort of timeline of events where Trump makes a demand that, you know, Hamas responds to this proposal. You know, Hamas was supposed to gather in Doha to respond to his peace proposal, and then all of a sudden Israel drops a bomb. So some people are very suspicious about Trump's claims that they did not know of this attack and condemn it.
Borzu Daragahi on Wednesday's News at One. And then on Thursday in the United States of America at an event at Utah Valley University, the assassination of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. David Blevins, Sky correspondent in Washington, gave this account of the shooting to Claire.
Charlie Kirk was on the first stop of what he called the American comeback tour when he was fatally wounded at Utah Valley University. He was addressing a crowd of around 2,000 to 3,000 people when a single shot rang out and it claimed his life. Local law enforcement believe that shot was fired from a rooftop by a person wearing dark clothing, and it sparked absolute pandemonium, as you would expect, among those who were in attendance. And while they were fleeing the scene, a body was removed from the scene, and it was President Trump himself who later confirmed that the very well-known conservative influencer Charlie Kirk had lost his life.
The 31-year-old father of two was a massive figure in the MAGA movement, particularly for young people. Here's Anya on Morning Ireland with Washington correspondent Sean Whelan. But first, this is how the late Kirk's podcast opens.
Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
So tell us more about him, Sean.
He was a full-time political activist. He dropped out of college very early. He didn't like the kind of teachers that he had in college, thought they were far too liberal, far too left-wing. The term woke wasn't really even popular when he was 18. He died at the age of 31. But at 18, he did drop out, set up a political activist movement, and then had a vision, had a dream that he wanted to try and set up a nationwide political organization to try and bring the message of conservatism to young people in universities in particular, but to young people generally. He pitched his idea to wealthy backers, including the Trump Organization, about 10 years ago. And Eric Trump has spoken about that on television tonight, about meeting this 21-year-old kid, as he called him, walked into our conference room. And he was larger than life and had far beyond his age. He created this amazing national organization, according to Eric Trump. And he did it on the back of podcasting and going around, doing the hard yards, going out to these college campuses, doing exactly what he did yesterday when he was shot dead, and talking to people, debating with them. He had radio shows. He was on television programs. He was a frequent contributor, particularly on Fox News, but also would quite happily cross the political aisle to others. He appeared on Gavin Newsom's podcast earlier this year. The governor of California has started a podcast where he tries to reach out to his political opponents, and the two of them had a jolly old chat for themselves. So he became extremely popular amongst younger voters and is very much credited with turning them on to political thought and converting them in large numbers into Trump voters. So this guy was very well known in Trump world, was a frequent visitor to the Trump campaigns. Trump attended his Turning Point conferences and vice versa. They were very, very tight with the Trump family. One reporter from ABC News said the president in a short conversation sounded crushed and sounded very upset over the death of Charlie Kirk.
And on Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Republican Errol Moorcock. He's a political strategist and spokesperson for Republicans Abroad UK. And he knew Charlie Kirk personally.
Do you know, Errol, if he ever worried something like this could happen as he gained more fame and more followers? And obviously there's been, you know, a string now of attacks targeting American political figures on both left and right. Is this something, do you think, that ever played in his mind as a possibility?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it was his abject and overt faith in Jesus Christ that made him have the courage to go out there and keep doing it. There had been open threats on his life. He had a security team there. I mean, but a security team is not prepared to handle a sniper bullet. This is a college campus. And I think they could have stopped anybody who was coming in with a normal threat. But he knew the risks. And every day he went out there and he put himself on the line.
But with gun violence an increasing feature of political life in a seemingly ideologically riven America, what are the wider implications for civil society and politicians? Yesterday, Claire spoke to Mike Wendling, BBC reporter specialising in conservative politics in the US.
Perhaps the majority opinion, or perhaps you might call it the silent majority, people are condemning the violence. We have statements from public officials. However, there's a very strong different reaction that's coming from different quarters. And I'll explain it like this. There are some people out there, many of them, from the left wing of the United States, who are saying that who are either condoning or celebrating or downplaying this murder. On the other side, there are people, including some people who are very close to Donald Trump, people like Elon Musk, people like the conspiratorial influencer Laura Loomer, who are using very inflammatory language, using words like war. Elon Musk tweets, "The left is the party of murder." Leaving aside that there is no sort of left party, it's hard to really know what he's talking about there. They're calling for retribution in general terms, and basically using the sort of demonizing language that they have accused their opponents of using against people like Charlie Kirk. So it's quite a fractious atmosphere in the United States right now. Mm-hmm. We are at a very dangerous point, I'd say.
The BBC's Mike Wendling with Claire yesterday. And there we will leave it for now. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Well, let's end that there because we didn't, did we?
No World Cup on the horizon. Are we at rock bottom now?
Yeah, pretty much, Keane.
We'll have a minute's silence for men's Irish football, will we?
Not good. The Republic of Ireland slumping to a 2-1 defeat to Armenia, all but ending our hopes of qualifying for the World Cup. If you work out the sums, there is some sort of way we could qualify, but we'd have to beat Portugal home and away. And like, let's be honest, that ain't going to happen.
Ooh, a crestfallen Park Lodge on Morning Ireland. And if you were looking to hear the choked sobs of the grown-ups just about holding it together, Tony O'Donoghue talked to these fans about to fly home from Armenia.
It was a very difficult night. We were overrun in midfield. Our defence were sloppy. We weren't pressing. It was disastrous.
You follow the team all over the world, really. Where do you think they are at the moment?
They don't know what they're at. It's a mess. It's a mess. I would at least expect them to work hard, and they didn't really last night.
What about yourself?
Yeah, I was very surprised. The Armenian goalkeeper at first half and even the second half, he kept kicking the ball out to touch pretty much. And it was only at the end when Evan Ferguson put him under some real pressure. And that was almost 90 minutes. Midfield, they were running through us. And it really exposed the back line. And I think Kelleher was the only one who put in a good shift.
Which
and
I
just can't explain the lack of real effort that I saw on the pitch.
Irish fans follow this team everywhere. It's an expensive habit or hobby, if you like. Do you feel you're getting the rewards from following this team?
No. The short answer. You know, it's a long way to come. A lot of, you know, early morning flights and to go out and play like that against Armenia, with all due respect, who aren't exactly a footballing powerhouse. Not much you can say about it. I don't know where we go from here, and I think it could get worse, personally, but, you know, I don't know where we go from here after that. It's shocking, to be honest.
Leaving it all on the pitch? Not quite.
Many pundits are calling Ireland's painful World Cup loss last night a new low and probably one of the worst results in our history as a nation in football, not to overstate it. Ken Early from the Second Captains podcast joins us now. Was it that bad, do you think, Ken?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might say that, was it?
Oh, man, in the glory days we've had, Cormac had the audacity to put this to him.
Are we only disappointed because of our own delusion about our standard? And maybe this is the standard we're at.
Oh, kick a man when he's down.
Well, football is all about delusion. I mean, that's what it is.
You should be a politician.
It's an experience shared delusion, you know, and it's actually quite a good thing in some ways. I mean, I think that our standard would have entitled, poor as it is, would have entitled us to expect to beat Armenia, who are ranked much lower than us and who have lost nearly all their matches. I mean, last year, you know, less than a year ago, they were losing 1-0 at home to the Faroe Islands. You know, so really, we should have been able to win this game, and to perform as badly as we did was shocking to see. I mean, in a game of such importance, which had such a lead in, everybody understood the stakes, to go out there and flop like that, that was a really shocking thing.
Enough of that. What about a fight to the death we can all get behind?
It's been so long since I heard people around the place, out and about, talking about an Irish TV show. It's like the old days, really, isn't it? And I think it's because there are just regular Irish people who we know and identify in the show. It's a lovely obsession. And even though it's on late, I know the kids are mad into it around the country. I don't know how they're watching. Are they watching it on the player with their Rice Krispies in the morning? Or are they now up till all hours and falling asleep the next day during the times tables? I don't know how they're managing. But anyway, many, many...
Oh, we speak of the traitors, Garda Éamon talking out of the side of his mouth, and then, sweeter than honey, Caitlin, it is a masterclass in lying, cheating, backstabbing and general scheming. It would do the heart good. And on no less a programme than this week, Justin McCarthy got into the psychology and science of mendacity. Here he is with Dr. Gillian Murphy, Senior Lecturer at the School of Applied Psychology at UCC.
Within psychology, we would talk about the cognitive effort of telling a lie. And a lot of theories around deception really relate to that idea that you don't have an unlimited brain capacity, you don't have an unlimited span of attention. And if you are constantly trying to think, what would I say if this were true? And you're trying to build a very complex fake world, that requires a lot of effort. And so actually a lot of our strategies for trying to detect deception rely on trying to kind of max out that effort, trying to trip people up, trying to take advantage of the fact that actually constructing a lie and telling one can be very difficult when you're trying to monitor what you're saying, what you're not saying, trying to not let on, you know, the truth, that is actually very effortful, and you can use that fact to try to trip people up.
Of course, if you know the person, a much better chance of spotting their tells.
And so then when people are telling lies, do they have telltale signs themselves? I mean, do they change their body language? Do they shift their gaze in a way that might make a liar easier to spot?
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of popular beliefs about this. You know, you'll hear, like you said there, changing your body language, maybe scratching your nose or looking up and to the left. There are all these ideas that, oh, if someone does this, then they are lying. And what we know really from decades of research on this is that there are no singular reliable signs of deception. The signs are too faint and too unreliable. We really just can't rely on them at all. And so when someone tries to detect deception just kind of normally, just paying attention, is someone lying or not, they'll really only succeed at about chance levels. That, you know, they'll be right about 50% of the time. And even, you know, people who think they might be particularly good at it, often they're not. You know, they're actually not very good at it at all, because there are no kind of reliable signals. And that's why really most of us would find it easier to detect deception in someone that we know, because then you kind of, you have a sense of them and maybe you know what they look like when they're lying versus when they're telling the truth. When it's a stranger and you don't have that baseline behavior to relate it back to, there's no one switch in behavior that says, ah, everyone does this when they're lying. And, you know, there's a good reason for that. We evolved to be able to lie. There are social benefits of that. If we all did one thing when we were lying, it would kind of defeat the purpose of being able to lie. There's a reason that we're good at it.
And for Justin, professional prober, trying to spot inconsistencies or downright lies. Any tips or tricks?
How do you catch out a liar then? I mean, I find sometimes when you're interviewing people and you're trying maybe to tease out whether they're telling you the full truth on something, that you have to go into a sufficient amount of detail before they get caught out. Is that one way of doing it?
Yeah, certainly. And I definitely think journalists, police officers, border control officers, there's a lot of professions where getting to the heart of the, you know, someone's truth and really understanding if someone is lying is so important. And so there's a ton of research on this. And I think a lot of the time, people who have experience in these professions will kind of know what works and what doesn't. And it's exactly like you say, one of the kind of most effective models is this kind of cognitive model of deception. And it's this idea, like I said, that lying is effortful. And so a good way to kind of trip up a liar is to put more effort on them. So like you just said, make them go into more detail. Other strategies that, you know, you would actually see a lot in kind of true crime, if you ever watch someone being interviewed by the police, they'll sometimes say, tell us the story again, but start from the end of the story. Knowing that when you're telling the truth, you know, you might make mistakes and you might correct yourself and all of that, but it's not as effortful as trying to retell a complete lie. You know, it's much harder.
Oh, treacherous. But those treasures would not hold so much as a candle to the dark doings of the spider. Biodiversity officer at Trinity, Collie Ennis, joined the Darcy. But before the murder and the killings and the cannibalism, there is love, albeit of a dark, twisted kind.
This time of year, the males are off on a one-way trip, really, because once they mate with a female, they're generally eaten. And if they even get away, they usually lose an arm or half a face. You know, they're torn up. It's a very delicate operation for them.
So you could see, which is probably scarier than a fully intact spider. So you could see a spider with seven legs and a half a face.
I've seen them kind of like it's very like bashed up males. Yeah. And they're still in mating mode. They're still kind of got that drive just to mate.
So will you explain this and why nature lets this happen? So they breed, impregnate the female spider, and then the female spider turns on them.
Yeah, so it happens with not just with spiders, but I suppose the most famous one, apart from the Black Widow, would be the mantis, who are insects, not arachnids. But it's the same thing. In a lot of creatures, especially like invertebrates, once the female is impregnated, she immediately is just looking for a source of protein to feed.
Because
she mightn't get a chance to feed for months afterwards. And in spider mating, there's a lot of male sacrifice involved. Like some of them become copulatory plugs. They literally die after mating and hang out with the female. Some of them, you know, they sacrifice themselves as they're mating. Like the Black Widow males will turn their abdomen into the female's mouth and she'll start eating.
So there's, you know, that famous book, The Selfish Gene.
Yeah.
This is for the good of the species.
Good of the species, and also to ensure that his genes get passed on.
He's willing
his
to
alone.
Die.
He's willing to die. So he's a genetic courier. He's just there to pass on that code, and then he's done. But he's also kind of ensuring his offspring get a really good head start by sacrificing himself.
Sex, death and genetics. But the mother too will pay a price.
So then she's impregnated and she has a sack full of little
eggs,
little spiders.
The great description I like to give to anybody who's got a bit of a phobia at home. It's like a marble-sized sack under your sink or behind your fridge. And then after a few months, it starts to pulsate and it bursts open and hundreds of little spiders appear, and then they hang around the nest for a long time, and they'll either cannibalise each other and then disperse, or in some species like the laceweb spider, mother will actually sit in the web and she'll start to gyrate a little bit and vibrate, and the young come and attack her and eat her.
Right.
Oh yeah, the natural world. But we can't leave the little critters on that bum note. Thankfully, Mooney Goes Wild had a squeak and a question.
Here is an unusual sound. And it comes with an email. It says, "Hello, Derek and team. I live in rural County Mayo near Loch Mask. For the past number of weeks, there is a mysterious nocturnal noise which appears to come from two fields away. It starts just after dark and goes on for hours, an intermittent, high-pitched sound. Have a listen." He goes on, "I don't know if it's natural or man-made. I recorded it on my phone, file attached. Can you identify it, please?" And it comes from Michael Lang. Niall.
Well, I can answer Michael's question there. It is natural. It is not man-made. And I'm willing to bet that that sound from two fields away is coming from probably a row of trees or a clump of forest at the edge of an open field. I know that sound well. We get a lot of people talking to us about it here at Mooney Goes Wild. Also, Birdwatch Ireland gets contacted every year with this sound. It's the begging call of a juvenile long-eared owl. A young owlet that's not long out of the nest, begging mum and dad to come and give it mice or shrews or small mammals like that for its food. One of the best times of year actually to try and find owls, sort of the latter part of the summer into the early autumn is when they do this. When they just left the nest and they haven't learned how to be quiet yet and how to keep a low profile, because they're not relying on their skill to hunt, they're still looking for mum and dad to feed them. Even though they're well able to fly at that stage, when you see them flying, they have big feathered wings, they look like very adult-like. As soon as they land, they look like fluffy little teddy bears. They haven't got the full feathers of an adult and they're kind of helpless without mum and dad to feed them. So that's what it is.
Another mystery sound for you, Niall, to identify?
That sounds like a dog barking, Derek.
It is indeed.
Groan. On Sunday, Miss Eleni, in association with the Irish Architecture Foundation's Bog Bothy project, a celebration of our peatlands. This is Bog Casket by Claire Cotter.
Bogland, place of mists and sudden fairy winds, big skies, black rain, liminal space liked by hares and frogs, and snipe, the bog bleater, and Jesus spiders that walk on water, and sundew and butterworth plants enticing their insect victims with sugary snacks. Nighttime brings the shapeshifters, Will-o'-the-Wisp, Liam na Lasoiga, a big badger seen shaving himself by the light of the moon in a Mayo bog. In Westmeath, at first light, a crowing cock turns into a white horse. But different in daytime, a day on the bog, oh, the emigrant longing for it, the manosphere of schlan, sods, ricks, banks, donkeys, creels, and tea brewed in blackened kettles. I'll settle down forever on the bogs of Shanna Heaver. But so many of Ireland's bogs gone now, hardly a curlew left to mourn them. Red bog, bog of the beautiful trees, bog of the cats, bog of the yellow fence, bog of the trackway, bog of the lake of the king's evil, bog of the ring, featherbed bog.
Oh, very evocative. That was Bog Casket by Claire Cotter from Sunday Miss Eleni. Back in a bit. Welcome back. A couple go to a wedding and think about their own marriage, one that may or may not get through the evening. On the Drama on One, Heaven by Eugene O'Brien.
Mal is the old man, the hubby. The jockey once upon a time, oh yeah. But now the comfortable shoe, the rock. The Mal from the county of Limerick. I'm down there 20 years now, ever since we got hitched, in the city. By Jesus, it's improved. Used to be some kip. The city of love, I joke, if you can avoid getting stabbed. I speak my mind. And as I say, Mal is never happy and is nappy about that, but sure, he's given up long since trying to... You know, that's one good thing about Mal. He never tried to change me.
She isn't everyone's cup of tea. She doesn't edit. It all comes out and be the holy fly, it can cause ructions. She's always taking the piss out of me, but it's affectionate. The day she stops doing that, then I know we are in trouble. She came into my life at a real important time, a vital intervention. Anyhow, I better wake her.
Heaven, the Drama on One. Well worth a listen back. Now, how about this?
place for something just a bit different. On Giant at My Shoulder, Mel Mercier paid homage to his teacher, Javanese gamelan player K.R.T. Wazito Dinangrat, or Pat Chokro, as he was known to his friends and family.
I met Pat Chokro for the first time in 1989, when I walked into the beginner's Javanese gamelan class at CalArts. He was 80 years of age, and after almost 20 years in the United States, he was coming to the end of his teaching, performing and composing career. I was 29, just starting out really. Like the other students in the class that day, I sat cross-legged on the floor, surrounded by the instruments of the gamelan, the classical Javanese orchestra, a set of up to 60 tuned bronze gongs and metallophones, drums, wooden flute, two-stringed fiddle and zithers. Pat Chokro sat on a chair a little distance away facing us. I remember he was soft-spoken and quietly charismatic. He held the space gently while one of his senior students, Greg McCourt, instructed our group of 12 or so novice players in some basic gamelan playing techniques. As well as it being my first time meeting Pat Chokro, it was my first encounter with the physical instruments of the gamelan orchestra, the physical sensation of the large vibrating gongs moving the air around me, and how as we each played our individual musical patterns, the elegant, almost cathedral-like architecture of the music was slowly revealed to us. Nothing in my previous experience of playing Bowron and Bones in Irish traditional music ensembles had prepared me for such total sonic immersion and musical intensity.
From Joined at My Shoulder. And more music, albeit of a different sort. Favourite album, Fanning, Muso on Muso, Nerding Out, which kind of made it great fun. Here Dave is with James Vincent McMorrow, and he loves alternative metal band Deftones, but he also slipped in a little bit of Neil Young.
I could equally talk about On the Beach by Neil Young, an album that I'm sure you're familiar with and that like had a huge impact on me.
I know, backwards. In fact, you know a sad thing now you said something? I can beach on that. Do you know, there's a cover on the beach, yeah, and he's looking out at the sea and the Corvette sticking out of the sand.
Yeah.
There's a newspaper there. I can tell you what the headline of the newspaper is.
Are you serious?
Senator Buckley calls on Nixon to resign.
Yes!
How sad is that?
No, that's beautiful. But that's what I mean. Like, those are the albums that like exist in this sort of like this timeless world for me.
B-sides, outtakes, borderline alienating, if it wasn't such a good listen. And he talked to Loa, and she's a fan of the 2007 Radiohead album In Rainbows. And for a band who are all so serious chin strokers, this was a departure of sorts.
It's the seventh album by them. They're very kind of human on this album, yeah, and a bit more loose and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And they've nothing else to prove, kind of thing. Mm. And it kind of really helped them. They became, I'm not going to say nicer, but you know what I mean? Easier to get into.
Yeah,
kind of, you know?
So relaxed.
Yeah,
and there
exactly.
was no intellectual forcing of like, we have to be seen as like this, that and the other, which obviously works really well. They're really good at proving themselves too.
Yeah.
But this felt so human and like vulnerable and sensitive. And I love when Tom York does that, his boy choir high falsetto. But they have the bangers on the album too. And it just felt so mellow and chill and gorgeous because it's like they've really actualized their skill and their humanity.
Yeah, but still really difficult to
but
interpret.
But still really hard. So yeah, let's not forget.
I mean, the old left field gloom rock stuff that people often thought, they really relaxed out on this and it really worked for Radiohead. They'd done so much. Okay,
totally.
let's go nude. Let's play the song then. What is it about nude? Because I mean, I must say, when I heard that this was the album, I said, I wonder what three tracks you'll pick. You picked three completely different ones than I would have picked.
Which is
it's a whole album, though, as you say. And also the whole band. I've never heard them so being all a five piece as much as I have here. And I think also that maybe did Johnny Greenwood and Tom York, who had the Eraser at the time, did they get a lot of their solo stuff out of the way?
Yes.
And they were relaxed without saying in any way I could shoehorn this stuff into
Radiohead. Forcing my tunes in. Yeah. It was like, let's do this. Well, I mean, their story and version of how it came together sounds like it was really hard, but as the listener, you hear the melange, you hear the group. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well then let's hear the group. This is Loa. No, it's not Loa, sorry. This is Radiohead.
I wish.
And, In Rainbows is the album from 2007, and this track here is called Nude.
you cannot beat a bit of Radiohead. But can you lick their face in the privacy of your own bedroom? You cannot.
Nobody is going to hear from me going forward. I'm just writing letters to everybody from now on.
That's it. Everyone's on your Christmas card list. People you fell out with 25 years ago are back on the Christmas card list.
That's absolutely it. I don't even send Christmas cards, but this year is going to be the year for me to send Christmas cards. Everybody is getting one.
Westlife, now on a stamp.
So where does absolutely. Westlife take you? Is it sort of the pure, unadulterated good fun? Is it the heart-tugging romance of reconciliation after breakup? Is it imagining the beautiful blonde tresses and brown locks of the various members of Westlife? Is it the dance? Is it the nice guy images? What is it about Westlife that has been part of the enjoyment?
I guess some of everything that you just said. I don't know how they captured the zeitgeist and... I don't know how I came to be a fan, but it just ended up that way. And yeah.
In fairness, not a lot of places for you to go after Colm's little love in there.
We'll make your day here. We'll hit a bit of Westlife again.
I go on.
They are your special thing.
Ah, they really are. They really are. That was my wedding song and everything. So, of course, they had to be a massive part of my wedding day.
Who was your favourite back in the day? Or do you still have a favourite?
My all-time is Nicky Byrne. Always has been from the time I was 7.
Is it the dub thing?
I don't know what it is. It's just that Nicky Byrne has always been my go-to. So, I've never changed. Always been Nicky.
Ooh, a little bit aux. Would you settle for Keane?
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Cian, Cian Egan, there's...
Hi, Cian.
Hello, how are you? I was listening to your story
Cian,
there.
We
thanks for all
for
your
you
lovely
this
words.
Morning. We were waiting patiently in the GPO this morning, but I know you're busy.
You're looking well in the stamps there, Cian. What do you make of them?
Ah, it's an amazing honour to be, you know, to be honoured like that by Ampost. And just, you know, I suppose, you know, when you hear all these things, it's not until your mother is ringing you up going, oh my God, I can't believe you're on a stamp, that you realise, you know, how special it all is, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's silver anniversary. Is it hard to believe?
It is hard to believe, you know. I mean, obviously we started the band when we were very young and, you know, we were 16, 17 when we started in Sligo. And then as the years rolled on, you know, we couldn't believe that we managed to have the career that we have. And here we are 25 years later. You know, still having an amazing career, getting ready to gear up for another big run at everything. And, you know, it's just, it's incredible. And the loyalty and support that the fans have shown us throughout the years has been so, so amazing.
Yeah, and we heard that Olivia there saying she's seen you around 30 times, which is more than once a year, is it, Olivia?
I think four in 1 year. Four concerts
wow,
in one,
hit you.
In 1 year. Yeah.
And what about yourself, Leanna? You must be hitting more than once a year at this stage as well, are you?
Absolutely. All of them. Like, I mean, as I said, the only one I missed was the farewell tour, but I didn't really miss it. I only missed it in body. I was there. I was on Skype the whole time. So, and I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning in Sydney at that stage as well.
We'll save you the price of one stamp here, Leanne, so you won't have to send Cian a thank you card. But what has the music? You can tell Cian yourself what the music has meant to you over the last 25 years.
Cian, it's absolutely magic. And anybody who knows me or knows my friend group or my family group, like, you've just hit home to every single one of us. And I think I can say that about every girl group anyway in Ireland. You are just...
Oh, these
are iconic.
Thank you so much.
Olivia,
it's always strange to hear things like that. But okay.
Oh, from Liveline. And that is it from this week's playback. I'm not here for the next fortnight, but talk to you upon my return. And yeah, should we have to? Yeah, that's what I found out, honey. What am I do without you? You make me feel happy.